Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 153. I'm recording it on Friday, July 31st, 2009. The P10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of the selection is Bumbly March. The title of the podcast is Contrarian Investing Almost Works. I remember the first time I heard about contrarian investing. Contrarian investing, for those who don't know, is an approach, a theory of investing in which the idea is to always go against the crowd, do the opposite of what most other people are doing. And there's a powerful insight at the core of the contrarian investing idea. And contrarian investing has many similarities to the rational investing model that I explore at the website and the valuation-informed indexing strategy that I explore and recommend. But it's not exactly the same thing. And I thought it might help to explain a little bit why contrarian investing is such a good idea, but then also explain why valuation-informed indexing is a little bit different and, I think, a little bit better. That's, I suppose, to be discovered over time, but I believe that. I first learned about contrarian investing when I was 20 years old. I remember this because it was a friend of mine in college. His name was Jay. He also went to high school with me, but we became more friendly in college. And Jay came up to me. He was very excited. It was one summer night. We were working in the library. I had a job there in the library. This was at Temple University. And he was all excited about contrarian investing. And he's telling me about it. And, you know, it often happens when somebody gets excited about something and they've been studying it. You get excited because you've been studying it. And I think this happens to me a lot. And you start, you know, you're effusive and you're telling somebody else about it. Oh, I found the answer, you know. And the other person just sort of, you know, nods their head and they're perfectly interested and they're, you know, it's perfectly fine, but they don't understand why this is so important. You know, this isn't a big deal to them because they haven't been studying it. And Jay was all excited, contrarian investing, this makes sense. And I was just saying, yeah, sounds good, Jay. You know, and I had no idea really what he was talking about. I, of course, know what the word contrarian means, but that's about as far as it went. And I remember, I know when this happened, because I don't know the exact day, but I remember going home. I was working at the library, and I went home, and when I went home, you know, I put together a sandwich for dinner, and there was a debate between Carter and Ford on the television. So I know it was 1976, summer, before the election of 76. And the only other thing that I recall knowing about investing at the time is that my older brother, Richard, had recommended that I read the book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. It's the reason I give this personal background is I find it very interesting how life is so often a circle. Things happen to us when we're young, and then for some reason they stick in our head, and then years later we sort of circle back to them. And I've had this phenomenon, there ought to be a name for it. I've had this phenomenon happen to me, I mean, I feel hundreds of times. It just happens over and over again. You're going through something and you see some connection. And I see a connection here with contrarian investing, Jay being so excited about it, and me now, you know, how many years later, 30 years later, doing a podcast about contrarian investing. And my brother, the only thing I know that I knew about investing, I may have known other little things, I didn't have much interest. I had no money to invest, certainly, so I wasn't invested in the stock market. But my brother had recommended the book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, which, of course, is the book that put passive investing on the map, popularized it. The academics had come up with the ideas, but Malkiel's book, you know, popularized it among middle-class investors and you know, led to, you know, the success of Vanguard, which was founded a few years later. And my brother liked that book. My brother was smart, and I, you know, admired him and took that into account. And I remember he was, and just like Jay, he was all excited about investing at the time. And he subscribed to Value Line. Value Line would come to the house. And so, you know, because he was so excited, I would try to get into it a little bit. And I'd look and, you know, Value Line has a lot. Boy, they put too many words on a page for this boy, you know. And you would think they would break it up with pictures, but they break it up with graphs. Instead of pictures, it's graphs, you know. So it's just more eye strain, you know, trying to figure out those graphs. But, you know, so I sort of toyed with it. I'd look at the things and read them and say, yeah, yeah. And then, and you know, my brother said, well, what would you invest in? You were going to invest in something. I guess, I don't know if he was trying to get different opinions. And I said, Warner Brothers. Because Warner Brothers had all the good groups. They had all the good rock and roll groups. I don't remember now who they had. I know they had Captain Beefheart, who I liked. I think they might have had, I think they had Bonnie Raitt. I think they might have had Van Morrison, and there were others that I just don't recall. But just about everybody I listened to was on Warner Brothers. And so I thought, Warner Brothers, that's the way to go. My brother said, well, that's stupid. You know, you don't invest in things just because you like the thing. That's a bad reason to invest. That won't work. And I said, yeah, I guess that is stupid. And, I, you know, at the time, what he was really expressing was contrarianism. That's really what he was saying, is that if you just invest in things you like, I mean, partly he was saying don't be emotional, you know, you're investing in things you like because you're emotional, but partly it was contrarianism, because the fact, it turned out the joke was on him, because I look back at it years later, I don't know how many years, 5-10 years later, and Warner Brothers had quintupled, you know, it was a huge, I think they were bought out by some huge conglomerate. So Warner Brothers ended up doing very, very, very well. But so it wasn't such a stupid idea after all, but the reasoning might have been stupid, but the result wasn't stupid. But, you know, this is important. The point I'm going to make here is very, very, very important. It's foundational. Stock investing, I record my podcast for the average, the typical middle-class investor, not for experts. Typical investor. These are the people I think need help more than anything else and more than anyone else. And the ones who are being damaged by the conventional advice more than anyone else. And the big problem we have is that the typical middle class investor thinks that stock investing is complicated and hard to understand. And as a result, defers to experts. And that's dangerous. It's good to learn from experts. Experts have things to teach you, but experts are compromised because almost every expert you hear discussed on television and in websites and all this sort of thing have ties to the stock selling industry, which biases them in favor of stocks. So the advice you get is not good. Not good. The reason I would like to change this, I would like us to get to a point where we stop deferring to these experts. But we're always going to defer to the experts as long as we feel confused because, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, it's sort of like when you go to a doctor, you'd like to sort of know if he's really right what he's saying, but you're not a doctor and you don't know, and so you sort of defer to him. And we think these experts know everything. Well, the truth is investing is not hard to understand. It's fairly simple to understand. But there's one thing that makes it very confusing, and that's this issue, and it's at the core of the contrarian strategy. And the contrarians understand this point, and if you understand this point, I think they go a little too far with it, but they do understand it. And the point is, with every other thing we buy, it's good if the thing is popular. So, you know, when you're thinking about a record to buy, you know, The fact that the group is popular, sometimes popular songs are of course awful, but the fact that it's popular indicates there must be something there. Whereas if the album hasn't sold any copies, you're sort of dubious. If you buy a car, if it's popular, if it's selling millions, you tend to think a lot of people like it. There must be a reason. It has good word of mouth. People are talking about it and others are buying it. When you go to a restaurant, you know, if there's nobody waiting in line, you're sort of suspicious. If the place is packed, you say, yeah, you know, there must be something there that's making people wait in line. So the rule of life is, you know, I always make the point about investing. I say this over and over and over again. You have to look at price. This is the key point of investing. It's the key thing you need to know. And we look at price when we buy everything else in the world. We look at price when we buy everything else in the world, when we buy cars and bananas and comic books and houses and everything else. So why don't we do it when we buy stocks? But see, what makes stocks tricky is, in all these other things we buy, cars and it is, houses are sort of weird, but houses are more like stocks, but say cars and comic books and bananas, when the price is, when the item being bought is popular, that doesn't affect the price. If a book or a record or a comic book is popular, that doesn't mean it's more expensive. It's the same price as the unpopular ones. So popularity tells you something good. Popularity tells you this is a good buy. It's a good signal. But with stocks, that's not true. With stocks, popularity means expensive. Because when a stock becomes popular, or when the stock market as a whole becomes popular, the price goes up. Because the same people buying are also the same. You're not buying from a different entity. So there's no price negotiation. So when middle class people like stocks, when they become popular, they bid the price up. So popularity is actually a bad thing as a rule, as a general rule, with stocks, either in individual stocks or as the stock market as a whole. Popularity is a bad thing. Not because popularity in itself is bad, but because popularity translates into high price, and high price is bad with stock, just like it is with everything else, just as you would think it would be. But see, the thing that's confusing is this, we're used to thinking popularity is good and popularity is bad. So you could be, you know, pick a company, say it's Apple Computer. You could, a lot of people look at the company and they say, you know, the management is good, the products are good, the corporate philosophy is good, blah, blah, blah. The stock's got to be good. No, that's not true. If the stock is unpopular and all those things are true, then yes, it's a great buy. If the stock is at a reasonable price and all those things are true, yes, it's a great buy. But if the stock is popular, which means it's high priced, then that defeats all of those good points. No matter how good the management is, no matter how good the products are, if the stock is too expensive, it's a bad stock to buy. Because even though Apple may have great years, 10 great years in a row, it can't live up to its price. The price makes it a bad stock. And the same thing's true of the U.S. stock market. It's a great stock market. It's had a great track record. It's, you know, there's lots of reasons for thinking it's going to do well in the future. But when it becomes too popular, as it was from 1996 through 2008, it's a bad long-term buy. Because it's just, the price is just too high. Okay? If I could get that point across, I feel like I could save the world. Because it's quite true. Our entire economic system today is in jeopardy of, you know, going over a cliff because people don't understand this. That's how bad it is. Because middle class people put most of their retirement money in stocks at a time when the long-term value proposition was very, very, very poor. And as a result, they lost a lot of their retirement money, and now they're afraid to spend, and that's causing our economy to collapse. And if only we understood that popularity with stocks is a bad sign, not a good sign. So, in a way, that's what I think my brother was telling me. You know, don't buy Warner Brothers just because you like Captain Beefheart or Bonnie Raitt or Van Morrison. You know, just because they're popular. Well, Captain Beefheart wasn't popular. Bonnie Raitt was only popular years later. But, you know, don't buy because they're popular, because as a stock, that's not a good thing to do. But it turned out in the case, see, it's not perfect. This idea that popular is bad isn't always true, because a popular thing can become even more popular. And while Warner Brothers was popular at the time, you know, whenever this was, when he told me about the book, I think it was a couple years earlier, maybe 74, 75. Warner Brothers became all the more popular over the next few years. So at some point, that rule would have kicked in and my brother would have been right, that popularity would have been a bad thing. But see, you never know when exactly. You see, this is like I always say, short-term timing doesn't work, only long-term timing works. All right, that's preface. But that's the great insight that contrarians have going for them. If you want to learn about contrarian investing, read the book, I think it's called, is it called Contrarian Investing by David Dreman? I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Dreman. He writes for Forbes, I believe, a column. And he has a great book. I think it's called Contrarian Investing, but there was a new edition of it, and he might have called it The New Contrarian Investing, something like that. But certainly worth reading if you want to know about contrarian investing. But contrarian investing is rooted in, and this is what Jay was so excited about. It's rooted in this powerful insight that stocks are weird in that when they're popular, they're bad. And when they're unpopular, they're good. And that throws people. And so the vast majority of people that put money in stocks don't do well because they think stocks are like everything else, where if it's popular, it's good. And so they wait for everybody else to buy stocks. They're sort of nervous. Most of us are nervous about stocks because we don't understand them. So we wait for everybody else to buy. And then when everybody else buys, we say, okay, it's safe to go in now. And by the time you think it's safe to go in, it's probably very, very, very dangerous to go in. It's the worst time to get in. But that's how we think about it, because we think popular equals good. The contrarians have figured this out. And their idea is, okay, nobody seems to get it that popular is bad when it comes to stock investing. So here's what we'll do. We'll just go with whatever's not popular. We'll just find out what's popular and do the opposite. And that's contrarian investing. And as I say, it's rooted in a very powerful insight. But my take on it is it goes a little too far. That the rational investing model that I'm trying to develop with the help of my fellow community members is a more balanced, moderate approach. It clearly has contrarianism in it, but it's not strictly a contrarian philosophy. So the idea of this podcast, Contrarian Investing Almost Works, is to advocate the key insight of contrarian investing, but to temper it, to temper enthusiasm for contrarian investing by pointing out its weaknesses so that you don't become a total contrarian. Contrarian, in my view, it's a little too cartoonish to be a strict contrarian. So, point number one that's bad about contrarianism, it's too extreme. Now, of course, there are different types of contrarians. You could be sort of just a moderate contrarian, and I guess you could say that's what I am. I think contrarianism is rooted in a very powerful insight, a very important insight, the most important insight of stock investing. But I try not to take it too far. So valuation-informed indexing is sort of a moderate contrarian strategy. It's not a full contrarian. But if you go full contrarian, a full contrarian might, for example, be shorting the market. You know, when the market went to insane price levels in 96, the contrarian would say, okay, we're at the highest price levels, you know, ever seen. I mean, in 96, I think we were around 25, 26, PE10 level. That's not the highest ever seen, but it was awfully high. The highest we had ever seen before was 33 in 1929, and every time we had gotten to 26, we saw a major crash. So a contrarian might have said, okay, you know, everybody's buying stocks. Everybody thinks stocks are great. You know, books coming out, stocks for the long run. This is the time to be contrarian. This is the time to be anti-stock. I'm going to short the market. Shorting means you make money if the stock market goes down. And they shorted the market, and they were wiped out. They had their heads handed to them. because stocks were insanely priced in 96, but they went up in 96 big time, and they went up 97 big time, and they went up 98 big time, and they went up big time in 99. They went up to a P10 level of 44, never ever reached before in the history of the U.S. market. And the contrarians, the pure contrarians, the contrarians who shorted the market had their heads handed to them. So contrarianism is, it's rooted in a powerful insight, but you've got to be careful because there are two things that determines what the contrarian is really doing is saying, when things get overpriced, the economic realities are going to bring the price down. And that's smart thinking. It's true. But stock prices are influenced by two opposite things. They're influenced by economic realities, which the contrarians are counting on, and they're also influenced by emotion, investor emotion. And investor emotion is completely irrational. Completely irrational. So, an investor emotion shows its influence through something called momentum, which means if stocks have gone up for a long time, there's a good chance they're going to keep going up. They have a tendency to continue going up. So there are two competing tendencies. When you get to a P10 level of 26, like we did in 1996, you've got two competing forces. You've got momentum saying, now that we're 26, we've been going up since 82, the likelihood is we're going to go higher next year. We're going to go to 30. We're going to go to 35. But contrarianism is saying, no, there's going to be reversion to the mean. If we're now at 26, there's this heavy pressure that's going to cause us to drop down to 14 or maybe to 8. And both forces are real. It's a tug of war between them. So the pure contrarian is making a one-sided bet. He's making a smart bet. It's intelligent from a logical standpoint. But it's not intelligent. It's not totally intelligent from a stock buyer standpoint, because stock buying, you have to consider, see, this is what's funny about it. If you're going to buy stocks, you don't really want to be logical, because stocks are not logical, because stock prices are set largely by emotion, especially in the short term. So you want to be a little illogical, you know, you want to be a little emotional, you know, that's sort of like my older brother. My brother was 10 years older than me. He was a lot smarter than I was. And, but when I said Warner Brothers, I ended up being right, even though I was just a stupid kid that knew nothing, you know, didn't want to read the charts, didn't want to read Value Line. I was emotional. I was caught up in the emotion of Warner Brothers, and that can pay off in investing. You know, they always make this point. You know, they say, the passives say, oh, if you throw darts, monkey throwing darts will do as good as a professional stock picker. Well, they do that to say intelligence won't help you. Picking stocks effectively won't help you, no matter how intelligent you are. Well, it cuts two ways. If intelligence doesn't help you, the thing about throwing darts I don't think is strictly true, but there is a lot of truth to it. It is an important insight. But it cuts two ways. If intelligence doesn't help you in investing, dumbness doesn't hurt you either. They don't point that out very often, but it's true. If intelligence gives you no help, then dumbness gives you no drawback. If a monkey can pick stocks as well as a fund manager, well, they're sort of making fun of the fund manager. They're saying the fund manager is no better than a monkey. But the other way to say it is the monkey's no worse than the fund manager. So I was essentially a monkey in 74, whenever it was I was talking to my brother. I had this conversation when I said Warner Brothers and he said, you're stupid. I was essentially a monkey, but I was a monkey who was proven right. And that is what's tricky about stock investing, because you can't trust the experts, because intelligence isn't what wins the day. But you can't say I'm not going to be intelligent, which is what the passives do. Passive investors say intelligence doesn't matter, therefore I'm going to turn my brain off. I'm just going to stay at the same stock allocation no matter what. And that's not the answer either. That's also an extreme reaction. I think the correct reaction is to understand your limitations, to understand that intelligence is not going to necessarily win the day, but to also understand that intelligence does have value, and to sort of have a humble intelligence. In any event, looking at what other people are doing and then doing the opposite is contrarian, and it's extreme. So that's the biggest mark against contrarianism in my mind. The insight is real. The insight is very, very powerful. But you don't want to be a pure contrarian. But you do want to always exhibit contrarian thinking. Whenever you see somebody say something about the market, you want to be thinking, what's the other side of the story? See, that's smart. That's smart investing. But you don't want to give in totally to the appeal of contrarianism. You don't want to get too effusive about it, too enthusiastic about it, and lose sight of the fact that sometimes all the dumb people investing emotionally rule the day. And they ruled the day from 96 through 99. And if you gave in to the intelligence telling you to invest in a contrarian way, you would have hurt yourself in a very serious way. Now, a second big problem I have with contrarianism, and I base this, I haven't studied contrarianism in any great depth, but I occasionally have looked at columns by Dreeman. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Could be, I don't know. I just don't know. I've never heard the name pronounced. I've seen it written. Dreman. He's very smart. He understands the effect of valuations. He understands that the efficient market theory is baloney. So I like him a lot as a writer. I know John Walter Russell loves the book, The New Contrarian Investing. But presumably he makes good stock picks. I think in this column in Forbes, he will pick stocks he thinks are good, and I've never checked them out, but given his intelligence, I wouldn't be surprised if he has a pretty good track record. My understanding is that he charges a lot. He has a fund or something and has big fees on it. But, you know, maybe whether it's worth it or not, I can't say. But what occasionally has made me uneasy is I've looked at his column, and even when stocks were insanely overvalued, see, my belief is from 96 through 2008, stocks were insanely overvalued, and the best advice was just go with a low stock allocation. Wait until this storm of insanity passes. You know, be defensive now so you'll have money left to invest when the insanity passes. Dreeman was picking stocks. You know, he was saying, yeah, some stocks are overvalued, but go with these others. Now, that can work. I don't say it can't work, but I don't get the feeling that contrarians, I imagine it's sometimes they go with higher cash allocations than others, but I don't think they like to go to cash. They have a bias against it, as so many do. Almost all the schools of investing have a bias against safe investing, and I think it's an unfortunate thing. I have an earlier podcast called Cash as a Strategic Asset Class. So I would have more confidence in contrarians if they could recommend cash for long periods of time, however long it takes for valuations to get normal. But what they try to do is outsmart the market. Now, as I say, it can work. I don't say Dreeman can't do it. He's smart enough, he might be able to do it. But I think there are times when you're just better not in stocks. And that seems to be almost a mortal sin among some people. You just never get out of stocks. And a lot of people have realized this year, a lot of smart people, I think of Rad Doctor, radiology doctor, who used to post at the Fireboard and at Motley Fool. And he was a big believer in the safe withdrawal rate studies being wrong. He helped me a lot learning about that issue. And he believed that valuations had an effect, but he was trying to outsmart the market. He said, well, I'm not going to invest in the S&P, but I'll invest in, small cap or something. I don't know what it was exactly. Value funds, I imagine. I think it was value and small cap that he liked. It's my recollection. But what happened in 2008 is everything went down. I don't know exactly how those two classes did, but a lot of people who were shifting their stocks into different areas, you know, they're maybe getting out of the U.S., going international, whatever it is they were doing, just about everything went down in 2008. But cash didn't go down. I had I-bonds paying 3.5 real. They kept paying 3.5 real. And they actually went up, in my estimation. I explained why in the podcast. The short version is, when stock prices go down, the value of my cash holdings explode. Because now I can take that cash and convert it into stocks with a much higher long-term value proposition. So for me, the stock crash was a good thing. I don't say that to gloat. I feel bad for my friends who have lost money, and I'm frankly concerned about what that stock crash is doing to our economy. If the economy goes over a cliff, we all lose. So I don't say that to gloat. However, it's true that when prices went down as much as they did in almost all equity, groupings, that enhanced the value of my I bonds. Not in a sense that I can trade them in for a higher value. I still get the same value, but I can change them. I can get rid of the I bonds and use the money to buy stocks, and the stocks that I buy will be paying far higher returns than the stocks I could have bought before the crash. So, my holdings went up in value when all these other holdings went down, and so I think contrarians, they appreciate the overvaluation problem in stocks, but I don't think they fully appreciate how much cash helps. They don't understand the value of cash. In my experience, I haven't studied them in depth, but my sense is contrarians don't fully appreciate, many contrarians, I don't want to say all, many contrarians don't fully appreciate the value of cash. So I don't think they put enough focus on cash. Whereas valuation-informed indexing focuses on only two asset classes, stocks, broad U.S. stock index, and some form of inflation-protected cash investment, I-bonds or TIPS, possibly CDs, which are not inflation-protected. But if you believe that you can purchase them at a time when inflation is out of control, you could use CDs. But you're basically going with, it's so simple. Valuation-informed indexing, you only need to know about two asset classes, and one of them, cash, is there's nothing to know. And the other one, stocks, you're just using the historical data. And you're just presuming that stocks will perform in the future somewhat as they always have in the past. So that's my second caution about contrarian investing. My third caution is that they don't stress enough that stocks are generally best. Now, again, they're different contrarians, so you can't make any rules that apply to all of them. But some contrarians, some contrarians focus on things like gold. When stocks are overvalued, they'll say, get into gold. And Harry Brown, I think of as being in this category. My friend Artie sometimes posts at the blog. He's put forward a lot of good comments at the blog. Two guest blog entries. But Artie likes an idea that was put forward by Harry Brown, who I would call a contrarian. And Harry Brown is dead, but Harry Brown was a libertarian in his politics and sort of a contrarian, I think, in investing. He loved gold. I think he made a lot of money investing in gold, maybe in the 70s. And Harry Brown had a book called The Permanent Portfolio, and he said you can't predict stocks, you can't predict investing in general. And I think he made some good arguments. And he said, put your money 25% in stocks, 25% in bonds, 25% in cash, and 25% in gold. And he said, if you have those four, you're covered under all scenarios. Some scenarios, the gold will do super well and the others will all do bad. Some scenarios, the stocks will do really well. But you're covered for all scenarios. Now, I thought intellectually he made a very interesting argument. I liked Harry Brown's argument a lot. And I did my investing work when I was trying to put together my retire early plan. And my first inclination was to go with the Harry Brown permanent portfolio. But I was uneasy about it. It seemed a little too extreme to me. I didn't like the idea of having 25% of my money in gold, which doesn't generate any annual return. And cash generates a very small return. And bonds, I don't understand all that well. And cash, I felt, was overvalued. So I just sort of had the creeps about it, even though theoretically I liked it. And that sort of forced me to develop my own approach, which turned out to be valuation-informed indexing, changing your stock allocation based on valuations on a rare, once every 10 years or so. And that way avoiding the biggest risk of stock investing, but making stocks your primary asset class. And then when stock prices are too high, protecting yourself with TIPS or I-bonds. So what I feel is missing in the permanent portfolio, although I do think you should, I think it's worth study, it's worth exploration, it's a very interesting idea. what I think is missing is that I personally believe, as do the passive investors, that stocks are the best ticket to wealth for the middle-class investor. And maybe some won't think that after the losses they've suffered in the crash, but I feel that those losses are due not to stocks. They're due to the fact that people overinvested at times of high valuation. So I don't think you can blame stocks for that. But I think stocks are the ticket to middle-class wealth. And so I don't like having 75% of my money in non-stock investment classes. And so my take is that the contrarians don't fully appreciate the value of stocks when they recommend things like gold. I think gold can have a place. I have a tiny bit of gold, but very small. Tiny bit of silver, but very, very small. I could see having more than I do, but I'm reluctant to have 25% of my money in gold. Maybe that's just a personal prejudice of mine. Maybe I'm just too wrapped up in all the media push for stocks. But I am persuaded by the evidence that the conventional experts put forward that stocks are the best asset class for the middle class. So, you know, it may be a bias, but I think the data makes a pretty convincing case on that point. I'm much more pro-stock than I am sometimes portrayed to be. I'm sometimes portrayed to be anti-stock, and I think it's just the opposite. I actually think I'm very pro-stock. If I have any bias, it's a pro-stock bias. The fourth point that I have against contrarian investing is that it does not stress enough that it is hard to pick the right stocks or the right sectors to invest in. Now, I believe that smart people can pick stocks. I have a podcast called Stock Picking Works, and I believe they can pick sectors. You know, radiology doctor, I think, can pick sectors. I don't think he can always protect himself fully by picking sectors, but I do think he probably can pick sectors to some extent effectively. So I don't say you shouldn't do that, but I think it's hard. I sort of agree with the passive investing mantra that I don't agree when they say stock picking never works. I think they have a good insight, but they push it too hard. They oversell it. So I wouldn't say never to pick stocks or never to pick sectors, but I would say to be cautious. And I think contrarians, they feel that they can beat overvaluation by picking stocks or picking sectors effectively. And maybe they can, maybe they can't. I think they have too much confidence in their ability to do so. My fifth point is, contrarian investing is not suited for the typical middle-class investor. Well, that's sort of a sub-point of the fourth one. If you have to pick sectors, or if you have to pick stocks, individual stocks, or you know, if you have to time in a short-term sense, it all becomes too complicated for the typical middle-class investor. Valuation-informed indexing is deliberately simple. The idea of valuation-informed indexing was to take Bogle's ideas. Bogle, I think, is a genius in that he's the only big-name stock advisor that I know of that I feel has really focused on the typical middle-class investor. That's why I think he's so popular. He saw a market there. The typical middle-class investor was moving into stocks because our employers no longer provide for our retirement, so we had to be in stocks. And he served those people. And in general, I think he's done a good job. I think he made a huge mistake when he bought into the passive investing idea and argued that you don't need to change your stock allocation. But outside of that, I think Bogle's done a good job. And I think Bogle is right, that the typical middle-class investor should not be picking stocks. I think it's okay if you make stock picking your hobby and you spend a lot of time, I think it's fine. But if most people don't want to make it their hobby, and if you don't want to make it your hobby, I think you're better off in an index fund. But I do think you have to pay attention to valuations. But if you go to contrarian investing, the way it's usually described, you have to put a lot of work into knowing, you know, what the contrarian pick is. It's not that easy. In other words, if everybody's investing in stocks, you can't just say, well, I'm going to be anti-stock. That would be shorting the market, and that's very dangerous. So you really have to study if you're going to short the market. I don't recommend that for anyone. Even Warren Buffett tried shorting the market when he was young and said it's too hard. So that's dangerous stuff. But if you're not going to short the market, then you're going to have to pick sectors that you think are going to do well. And that's a tricky business. Not as bad as shorting, to be sure. But it's a tricky business. Or picking gold, or picking commodities, or picking oil, or whatever it happens to be that you're going into because you're contrarian and you don't want to be in stocks when they're overpriced. You've almost got to study stocks as a, you know, as a full-time business in order to succeed at it. So that to me is a mark against contrarian investing. It's just not simple enough for the typical investor. Caveat number six, it does not focus enough on probabilities. I have said that I call the model of investing that I just explore at the site, rational investing. I have said that in the long term, I think that name should change to probability investing. What it's really about is examining probabilities. Contrarian investors are doing that in a very broad sense. What they're saying is the probabilities of overvalued asset classes are low. Therefore, go do the opposite of what the crowd is doing. Well, that makes all the sense in the world. That does turn the probabilities a little bit to your advantage. But I haven't, and maybe it's because I haven't studied contrarian investing enough, but I have not heard contrarian investors spend a lot of time trying to figure out the probabilities of different possibilities. In other words, if you're going to be contrarian, does that mean if stocks are overpriced and you're going to be contrarian, it means you're not going to be in stocks. But does that mean you're going to short the market? Does that mean you're going to be in oil? Does that mean you're going to be in gold? Does it mean you're going to be in cash? What are the probabilities? Does it mean you're going to be in stocks? The valuation informed indexer holds some stocks even when stocks are insanely overvalued, because he knows that even when stocks are insanely overvalued, there is some probability, there's some chance that stocks are going to do well. So even at a time like 1996, when stocks are insanely overvalued, there's maybe a 25% chance that stocks are going to do well. So you want to have some money in stocks. So it's a for the rational investor, the valuation informed indexer, it's a probability game. And you never put all your chips on one outcome. You don't make big bets. Contrarian investing seems to me, my impression of it is, it's a little more of a big bet strategy. You're betting against the crowd. The idea with valuation informed indexing is not to bet against the crowd. It's to recognize, how can I put it? To recognize that the crowd may win the day, and therefore you should go with the crowd a little bit, but also to recognize that the crowd may change direction. And so to bet a little bit against the crowd, but not to overdo it. So it's a more balanced approach in my view. But the idea is to spread your bets, to diversify, you could say. You're not diversifying among asset classes, but you're diversifying among outcomes. You see that there are different scenarios. A valuation-informed indexer always has a hard time with the question when people say, what do you think is going to happen in the market? This is the most popular question that I get asked. What do you think is going to happen? And a valuation-informed indexer never has an answer to that question, never. Because we're always going under the theory that there's maybe three or four scenarios. And we don't know which one. We don't pretend to know which scenario is going to play out. So a valuation-informed indexer is always taking, some of his chips and putting them on one scenario and some on another, so that whatever scenario comes through, he does okay. He never gets crushed. A valuation-informed indexer should never suffer bone-crushing losses. Never. Never. That's a key point in this strategy, valuation-informed indexing. It's bone-crushing losses that cause investors to become emotional, both suffering them, living through them, recovering from them, fearing them, all these things cause emotion and cause anxiety. A key principle of valuation-informed indexing is you want to avoid that. But contrarian investors can suffer bone-crushing losses. As I say, if you went short in 96, you got killed. So what I see as a weakness in this approach is that it's taking bets that are counter to the conventional wisdom, which is good because it, that way you're bringing price into the analysis, and price is the thing that usually is being missed, and price is 50% of what matters. So the contrarians bring that element into the equation, but they overreact. They bet against the crowd instead of saying, well, there's a 30% chance the crowd's going to be right, and there's a 30% chance the crowd's going to be wrong, and there's a 30% chance it's going to sort of be a mix. And I need to be covered in all events so that I never suffer bone-crushing losses. And I always have something positive going on. I always have some positive result so that I'm getting good feedback on my strategies, good emotional feedback. See, I don't know that the contrarians focus so much on emotion. They're aware of emotion because they're aware of valuations. And valuations, of course, are emotion. That's where they come from. If it were not for investor emotion, there would never be overvaluation or undervaluation. But contrarians don't really study emotion, in my experience. They don't study emotion. So they're aware of it. They take it into consideration, but they don't study it in depth. And thus, they can get tripped up by emotion. I feel that they're a little too mechanical or a little too logical. Contrarians are logical, and that's normally a good thing. You know, most people consider that a good thing, but it's not so good in investing because stock prices are set largely by emotion. So you have to be logical. You don't want to give up logic, but you have to temper. You have to temper, and the way that I think that can be done is to just sometimes say, I don't know, to say, I don't know which scenario is going to win out. I'm going to sort of mix it up. I see three scenarios. So even though I personally sort of think stocks are going to do well, I'm going to not go with an 80% allocation. I'm going to go with 50 or 60. So that's I don't think contrarians look at the probabilities as much as I would like to see them do so. Point number seven, I sort of discussed this under six. It's not a sure thing. The contrarian, the fact that things will turn out opposite of what the crowd thinks is not a sure thing, and thus contrarian investing can lead to disappointment. And that's you know, it's very related to the earlier point. But again, it has to do with this emotional aspect of investing. See, it's not enough to get the logic right and to get the numbers right. You've always got to think, what if my strategy fails? See, what too many investors do is they spend all their mental energies trying to figure out what's going to work, what's going to happen in the market, and then put your money in and hope it works. And that leads to emotion because you're betting on something happening and you're never really sure. So the way to do it is to say, okay, what do I think is going to happen now? Now that I've got that answer, that's just the beginning of the analysis. The next step is to say, what if it doesn't? What's the second likely scenario? And then if the second scenario doesn't happen, what's the third? You need at least three scenarios. And then invest according to that, and you'll come to different allocations than if you put all your money on your first choice. And emotionally, that's a far stronger position to be in. Because then whatever happens, you are not going to be emotionally frazzled and you're not going to make mistakes. You know? Think of poker. When you're playing poker, sometimes you have a good hand. And, you know, you're inclined to bet big. But then you notice this other guy who usually doesn't bet big, he's betting big. And the thought occurs to you, he must have a really good hand because he's a conservative player and he's betting everything. And then you've got to make a decision. You've got a good hand and you think you'd win. But this other scenario is, you know, he's got four aces. And if you bet big, you're going to lose more than you want to lose. It's such a shame to have a good hand. You know, maybe you have four queens and you have a good hand and you're going to lose. You don't want to do that. So there's two scenarios. Now, one way to play it is to just say, look, I've got four queens and I'm going for it. And sure, you can do that. But another way to play it is to say, well, I don't want to, something's telling me, the way this guy's betting, that God knows what he has. He might have a royal flush. God knows what he has. And I'm gonna pull back. And even if I bet a couple hands, I've got a little money in it. I'm gonna. You could just cover. I mean, if it's possible to cover, fine. Make him show his cards. That's a good way to play it if you can. But if you can't do that, if other players keep raising, you might just want to drop out at some point, even though you have a good hand. But you don't have to win every hand. Don't, especially if you don't have money to lose, especially if you're in a situation where you don't have too much money left to lose. You don't have to win every hand. So you don't want to suffer these bone-crushing losses. So I think contrarianism can be a little cartoonish at times. And I'm sure that there are some contrarians that are more sophisticated than others. So the points I'm making don't apply to all contrarians. But these are just general impressions I have of some contrarians. I think contrarians are brilliant. The insight is brilliant. I don't mean, you know, this podcast can come off as anti-contrarian because I'm making all these bad points. But my general thought is contrarians are brilliant. They're aware of the element of investing that so few are aware of. It's the most important element. And valuation-informed indexing is a contrarian strategy. I think it would be fair to call it one contrarian strategy. But it certainly has elements of contrarianism in it. But I see it as a much modified, much reformed, much tempered form of contrarianism. It is certainly not a purely contrarian strategy. And the purpose of the podcast is to make two points. One, contrarianism is rooted in a powerful insight that price matters when buying stocks, that popularity is a bad thing with stocks, even though it's a good thing with just about everything else we buy. And that is the primary source of confusion. That's point one. And then point two is all of these caveats, which can make contrarianism not work. As good a strategy as it is, you can ruin it by turning it into something cartoonish. And valuation, the aim with valuation-informed indexing is to avoid that, to not go overboard with the contrarianism, to see that the contrarian outcome is one outcome, sometimes the highest probability outcome, but not the only outcome. One way to say it is, why does valuation-informed indexing, we've tested valuation-informed indexing against passive indexing, and it has provided superior results through the entire history of the market. John Walter Russell recently did a study showing that valuation-informed indexing ordinarily increases your annual return by 2 percentage points of return per year. It's amazing. Makes a big difference in the long term. But there was a study by, an analysis done by Norbert Schenkler at the Financial Webbring Forum, where he did a line graph showing that through the entire history of the market, valuation-informed indexing has been superior to buy and hold, to conventional buy and hold. Why is that? People are amazed by that. I think people find it hard to believe. It's one of the problems I have in persuading people is the news is just too good. They just can't believe it. How could there be something this good and nobody ever discovered it? The power of valuation-informed indexing is that it's not that the strategy is radical. You see, the strategy is very moderate. And the strategy actually, the funny thing about it is valuation-informed indexers and passive indexers did the same thing from 75 through 95. It's only 96 through 2008 when we parted company. So how does that one change, lowering your allocation in 96, how does that allow you to retire 5 years sooner? It just seems impossible. But here's why it does. I understand it, but only because I've spent time going through the scenario surfer and thinking about what I'm seeing. And now I think I understand. The reason valuation-informed indexing beats conventional buy and hold, always on a risk-adjusted basis, is that it's virtually a sure thing. There are very, very, very few sure things in investing. Most insights you will hear in investing, most of them have something to them. If they don't have anything to them, you never hear about them. They just die. So most of them have something to them. But a lot of them might only work 60% of the time and they fail 40%, or they work 70% and fail 30%. But valuation-informed indexing, look at the scenario surfer, run some scenarios. Valuation-informed indexing works 90% of the time. The odds are very high. It's almost a sure thing. And that's why I say it always beats buy and hold on a risk-adjusted basis, because a strategy that only works 10% of the time is extremely risky. So buy and hold is a high-risk strategy compared to valuation-informed indexing, because the odds of it winning are so slight. So even when it comes through, it's sort of like buying a lottery ticket. A lottery ticket can pay off. It's just a high-risk bet. And that's sort of what buy and hold is. It's a high-risk bet, passive buy and hold. The beauty of valuation-informed indexing, what makes it work, is two things. One, it almost always works. And two, then compounding is what makes it so big. You're sure of getting an edge. You're sure of getting an edge sooner or later. You'd never know when. Could take a year, could take 2 years, could take 5 years, could take 10 years. You don't know. But sooner or later, you're going to go ahead of the passive investor. And once you do, your edge is locked in. Because once valuations return to normal levels, the valuation-informed indexer goes back to a high stock allocation, just like the passive has. So the passive can never catch up. He has no chance of getting ahead of of making up the differential. Because from that point forward, the two are doing the same thing. So you only lower your allocation at a time when it's virtually certain to put you ahead in the long term. And then once you go ahead, you switch back to the passive strategy, to the buy and hold strategy, and then compounding puts you further and further ahead every year for the rest of your life. So you end up at the end of 30 years with sometimes double the portfolio. Yeah, your gains just compound and compound bigger and bigger, and it seems impossible. People look at it and they say, that can't be right. This one little change did that? Yes. A little change, if you're sure it's going to work, makes all the difference in the world in investing. Because of compounding, and because the amounts of money involved are so big. You know, when you're investing your entire retirement portfolio, you know, by the time you retire, it's going to be $1 million. So depending on when this happens, you don't know when it is you're going to go ahead, but it could be you're going to have a big amount of money in the pot at that time. So it's important to have a sure bet. And the contrarian approach strikes me, the pure contrarian approach strikes me as being too much focused on, it's smart, and it's focused on a high probability bet, but the probability isn't high enough. It's often a 70% probability, or a 60%, or maybe at the best an 80%. Valuation-informed indexing is a 90% bet, and that makes a difference. It's almost a sure thing, and those are hard to find in investing. And with compounding, the sure thing really pays off big time down the road. The eighth point, it has times, contrarian and pure contrarian investing has times of very bad results, and that leads to a temptation to abandon it. As I said earlier, you can suffer bone-crushing losses. If you short the market and the market keeps going up, that can wipe you out for life. If you lose your stake, you know, you've lost 10 years maybe. And even if the strategy works, you know, in other times, you're going to be so disgusted you're never going to return to it. So in the real world, it doesn't work. This is the mistake of taking too strong a bet in any direction. This is why I believe in a multi-scenario approach. Always, you know, hedge. Always hedge. But keep it simple. Don't hedge. You know, some people say hedge by, you know, buying European futures and, you know, REITs and all this sort of thing. That's fine if you're a professional. But the average middle-class investor can't do that. The average middle-class investor can get all the hedging he needs by through two asset classes, a broad U.S. stock index and, you know, a valuation-adjusted asset class that's safe, like TIPS or I-bonds. That's all you need. With those two fairly simple asset classes, you can hedge as well as the professionals, really. Not quite, but pretty close. You get 80% of the benefits with 20% of the work. The ninth point, this is important to me, It does not call for education of other investors. Now, the tradition in investing is that it's all selfish. Most investing advice is incredibly selfish. It's all about how you can score, how you can exploit this, and how you can get rich quick, how you can crush the market. And I think of rational investing very differently. I think of valuation-informed index, rational investing, which includes the valuation-informed indexing strategy, as a community project. Why do I do that? For a couple reasons. One, I believe that the stock market, I compare it to the environment. It's a public asset. It is something we all should care about. When the stock market is destroyed, as it always is when passive investing becomes popular, there's not one exception in the historical record. When the stock market is destroyed, we all suffer. So we all should care about protecting the market from reckless investing strategies. And passive investing is the most reckless of them all, as far as I'm concerned. So just as we all should be opposed to pollution of the environment or pollution of the ocean, we should all be concerned of pollution of the stock market through the promotion of reckless valuation ignorant strategies. That's one reason why I believe this is a community project. The second reason, which is just as important, they're both very important. The second is humans learn, we're not data processing machines. We don't learn by reading an article that makes good logical sense. Those can help, I hope. But we learn through other humans. And when other humans are being fooled, are being deceived into believing that passive investing can work, sticking with the same stock allocation through all valuation levels can work, we end up fooling ourselves. A lot of us think, oh, it's not my problem. Let those fools, you know, lose all their retirement money. Not my problem. I'm smart. I'm a contrarian. I'll exploit it. I'll make money from it. Ha ha. And what happens is the environment is polluted. You're hearing the same trash that everybody else is hearing, and it influences your thinking, even though you don't think it does. We're all influenced by what our fellow community members are saying. And it's a big problem in investing. And we should all want our fellow investors to be as educated as possible. The smarter they are, the smarter we are. It's a win-win-win. I don't believe in this stuff of, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Education is a free lunch. Educating people how to invest effectively is a free lunch for me and for everyone else. The more you know about investing, the more you're going to share good insights at the Retire Early and Indexing Boards, the smarter I'm going to be when you share your insights and when thousands of other community members jump in and do the same. So part of the rational investing model, a key principle is education of other investors, because it bounces back and helps us. And I don't see that in the contrarian strategy, or at least I haven't seen it focused on. My last caveat about pure contrarian investing is it has no means to acknowledge that it's wrong. Contrarian investing is a little bit of a circular loop. Say that you're contrarian, you bet against the crowd, and the crowd ends up being right, and you're wrong for 5 years, and your wealth diminishes while everyone around you is getting rich. What do you do? If you're contrarian, what do? You can stick with the contrarian and possibly lose even more, or you can flip and go with the crowd, and you might be doing so at the worst possible moment. The crowd might be just at that point. Look at what happened in the late 90s. Contrarians in 96 knew that stocks were overvalued. A lot of them shorted the market. And in 99, they flipped because they got murdered in 96, 97, 98, 99. And then they flipped. Then they went with the crowd. Then they got destroyed for going with the crowd. Contrarian, because it's just contrarian, it's just do the opposite of the crowd, there's almost no way to break the loop. If you're a contrarian, you're just going to keep thinking contrarian thoughts until you're dead. And of course, the same criticism is can be directed to passive. Passives, whatever happens, They just find some excuse. When passive gives good results, they say this proves the passive's work. Passive works. And when passive gives bad results, they say, it's the bankers. The bankers did it. But it'll work. Oh, it'll work in the future. Yeah, somehow it'll work. It's a closed loop. There's no way to prove it wrong because it's not really an idea. It's an emotion. It's rooted in emotion. It's an ideology. It's a dogma. Passive, that's certainly true. I think to a large extent it's true of contrarian. There is thought clearly that goes into contrarian. The idea of going against the crowd makes all the sense in the world. But, you know, there's thought that goes into passive. The idea that the stock market is a great place to have your money in the long term is also an intelligent thought. I think you have to integrate the key insight of passive investing, which is that the stock market is the best place to have your money in the long term. And integrate that with the key insight of contrarianism, which is prices matter. Popularity is a bad thing when buying stocks, even though it's a good thing when buying anything else. Integrate those two ideas and you've got valuation-informed indexing. The truth is a mix. It's not choosing one of the two forks in the road. It's figuring out how to travel both forks because there's truth. Passive investing is a half-truth and contrarian. I don't want to be too harsh about contrarian. I don't want to quite say it's a half-truth, but contrarians are right to rebel against passive. They're right to rebel against the conventional wisdom on investing. But I think we need a more nuanced rebellion. And I hope that the valuation-informed strategy is a more nuanced rebellion. So those are my thoughts. All these years later, I've come around to Jay's way of thinking. I think he was on to something. But whatever it is, 30 years? 30 years later, and plus a little, I am as excited about valuation-informed indexing as Jay once was about contrarian investing. I think contrarian investing has a lot to teach us. But I think some caveats are in order. And I think we need a more nuanced approach. And I hope that valuation-informed indexing never becomes a closed loop. I hope that we always remain open to critics so that we can incorporate criticism into the model and thereby make the model stronger and stronger over time. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.